Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, All About Bambi. I am one of your hosts, the currently Twitter-pated Bob Mackey, who is here with me today, as always.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, but you can call me Flower.
I choose not to. And yes, we are doing What a Cartoon Movie again. It is the beginning of the month, or perhaps the end of the month, depending on when you're listening to this. But in any case, we are covering Bambi, 1942's Bambi. In the past, we have covered Pinocchio, we have covered Dumbo, and we're keeping that fun 40s train a-rolling with Disney's last movie before they made all of their fun propaganda. And their last very, very good-looking movie for a very long time.
Yes, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous film, and it's that inspired many, many artists from then on, and there's such an interesting story behind it, and Bob illuminated the entire history and even read the original source material, though not in the original German, which was kind of lazy of him.
That's my one failing as a podcaster. I will become fluent in German when we cover Bambi 2. But until then, you will be hearing a little bit of the history of Bambi, but if you want to hear the entire thing and also the rest of the podcast, a play-by-play of the entire film Bambi, I'm guessing it's going to be like 4 or 5 hours long, just head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. You will unlock the rest of the Bambi podcast, as well as the entire catalog of What a Cartoon Movie to date. That is over 60 podcasts that are all between 3 to 6 hours long. Again, we've covered Dumbo, we've covered Pinocchio, we've covered most of the Disney Renaissance, we've covered every Toy Story film, we've covered things that aren't Disney, like Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe and The Secret of Nim. We have covered over 60 movies so far, so if there's something you want to hear, we might have done it, but if not, we'll probably do it soon. But again, the What a Cartoon Movie level is at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And when you sign up for $10, you also unlock the $5 level. Henry, what is happening at that $5 level?
There are tons of exclusives you get on top of the What a Cartoon Movie when you sign up there. Over 150 exclusive podcasts of us covering each month a new episode of Futurama and of King of the Hill. Plus, you get access to all of our previous ones covering Futurama and King of the Hill, and every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and many of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series. Plus, tons and tons more. Dig deep into the archives. You'll find some really cool stuff. But you only hear that and the What a Cartoon Movie if you sign up at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it is very easy to do so. You just go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up there. They give you a little code. You just drop that code into whatever you use to listen to podcasts, any podcast app or program you might have. And that way you can download and listen to all of our bonus podcasts alongside our free podcast and any other podcasts you might listen to as well as part of your podcasting lifestyle. And if you want to go a different route, Patreon has an app for any smart device you might have. But no matter which way you do it, it is so easy to access all the content waiting for you behind the paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Thank you so much for listening to this little ad up front. Now we'll let you get to our preview of our Bambi podcast. So I want to talk about the source material. You know, I said that Bambi has been forgotten, but the source material is even more forgotten. And yes, Bambi is based on something. It is based on the book by Felix Salten called Bambi, A Life in the Woods. And this is not a kid's picture book. I don't know the market for this book. It seemingly was intended for adults, but it feels like an all-ages book. But yes, Bambi is based on, you know, a fairly short book. It took me maybe 2 or 3 hours to get through it. But I really, really liked it, and I'm interested to talk about it because I feel like nobody actually knows about this. And I'm one of the few people in our modern lifetime to actually have read this.
No, I'm really interested to hear about it too, because, you know, I was like when we did Pinocchio and I was so used to hearing stories, or when we did Hunchback, I remember hearing or seeing so many listicles that were like, oh, the original Disney movie's not as effed up as the source material, and they list all the ways it's different. But I don't remember seeing that as much or anywhere for Bambi.
Well, the original source material is more effed up, but I think the book is so obscure that no one ever bothered reading it to find out. But thankfully, there is a new edition of Bambi that came out in 2022. This is the one I recommend that you all should read. It is a new localization from the original German. and it came out in 2022 by Princeton University Press. It has a new translation by Jack Zipes and a great introduction that covers a lot of information about the book, the context in which it was released, and the original author. I'm borrowing liberally from Jack Zipes' introduction. If you want to know more about this stuff, please check out that edition of the book and read the intro as well.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I always loved the hearing about the, you know, because I perused a little of the, when we did Christmas Carol, a little of that kind of info that was sprinkled into the those re-releases of it that give proper context. So I'm extra interested to see that for our dear friend Bambi.
Yeah, apparently the original translation fell into the public domain, and according to the guy who wrote this translation, it's not good. And I trust this bias source on that, where he talks about how, oh, they missed all of these expressions and idioms, and they missed the point of this and that. So definitely, like, in general, I say try to find the newest translation of something, an older book, and, you know, see if it's good. And it usually is much better, because we have the tools now to make localizations a lot better than they used to be.
I had heard that too about like Franz Kafka, but to speak about German authors in particular, like I read this great entire essay about how like Franz Kafka's work when translated into English for decades often missed that he was trying to be funny and that he was telling like these lines were meant to be jokes instead of just absurd or taken at face value, and that a good localizer remembers to try to be funny and keep in some sort of comedy to it.
Yeah, and often old localizations of things will cut out salacious content or content that was salacious when the books were printed in America or the UK, where they would say, oh, this might fly in France. We're not putting in this drug reference or this reference to homosexuality. Get it out of there. So yes, definitely try to avoid the public domain versions of things if there are newer translations. But I will talk to you about Felix Salten, who was born Siegmund Salzmann on September 6, 1869 in Austria-Hungary. So he came from a distinguished Jewish family that moved to Vienna and fell on hard times after a stock market crash, and from that point on couldn't financially recover. But despite his poverty, Salten aspired to be a social climber, and he set out to be a fully self-taught writer. So Salten's writing career began in 1890, and he had some of his short stories and poems published while working as an insurance agent. And I will say, yes, Bambi is a story about, you know, being hunted by these, you know, monsters from the outside while you're trying to hide yourself. And we have a Jewish guy born in the late 19th century. There's a connection there.
Interesting. Wow. I never knew that.
Yes, yes.
That's very interesting.
I mean, as I talk to you more about his biography, you can draw the comparisons yourself. So Salten wanted to be in the high society. He wanted to be a writer. He fell in with this group of influential intellectuals, most of them being middle-class Jewish people who assimilated. They regularly met at a cafe. They, you know, inspired each other. They worked together. Salten made and spent a vast sum of money. He had a lot of affairs. He, even when times were tight because he spent so much money, he even stooped to writing an erotic novel to pay the bills. So he did a lot of stuff. He was also a journalist. But in time, he focused less on wine, women, and song and got back in touch with his Jewish roots, because even though he assimilated into high society in Vienna, he had experienced anti-Semitism in his younger days. And he saw this rising once again in Europe and thought, like, ooh, I don't like this. So what's happening in the world around him in this nightmarish time is inspiring him to say, like, let's figure out what being Jewish means to me, and I'm going to explore that.
Wow, man. I had no idea it was so tied to his Jewish identity. That's amazing.
Yes. So, I mean, a lot of things are happening in Europe. World War I, for instance, is happening around this time period. Super complicated. No one ever talks about World War I. Devastating to people in Europe. Obviously, we show up late. We're not affected that much in America.
Take all the credit. It's just, talking about our doughboys. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it leads to World War II. We all know how it goes. So when this is happening in Europe, Salten finds peace and solace by walking the grounds of his own hunting preserve, because even though Salten wrote Bambi, he was a hunter. So there's a big contradiction there. But he did admire animals, and he loved animals. And a big thing about Salten was, in this super chaotic time, where anti-Semitism is rising, these world wars are starting. In his mind, he's like, I don't know what humans are supposed to do. Therefore, I now see animals as having the ideal life. That is where he's going with his mindsets.
Man, he's a land of contrast with this. Like, here he is. He's loving the deers, but also shooting and killing them. He's both Bambi and his attackers.
So I can't say it any better. I will quote Jack Zipes in the introduction to the new edition of Bambi. To quote Jack Zipes, Sultan longed to be close to animals, whom he regarded as pure, honest, and decent creatures, unlike the people of the Viennese society in which he lived and worked. His forays in the forest resembled paradoxical religious rituals in which he could cleanse himself of sin and then enjoy communion by hunting and killing the creatures he loved. In writing Bambi, despite his own contradictions, he hoped to reveal that nature was not a paradise, and that only when people truly understood how the animals suffered persecution from hunting in the forest could they create peace among themselves. So, a lot is going into this seemingly simple story of, like, what is growing up through the eyes of a deer?
Yeah, wow, I didn't, yeah, I thought it was just all about the, you know, a parable for growing up, and which makes it, I guess maybe I, perhaps I've just been reading too much One Piece that I'm viewing it all like, this is just a story about growing up for young readers.
You know, yeah, before I read the book, you know, I heard some things about it, but I thought it was like, oh, and then Bambi met the rabbit, and the rabbit was nice to him, and then he met a girl, and he liked the girl, and then his mom got shot, but then things worked out. I thought it was going to be like just a very simple, straightforward story, but no, it's a story about death and confusion and misery and alienation. It's very adult, and I can talk more about the actual content after I get through the biography of the writer. So, Bambi, the story of life in the forest, was first serialized in a Viennese newspaper in 1922. It was published as a novel in 1923 and finally received an English language release in 1928. So the book was a little over a decade old to English speaking audience members when Disney, when their version of Bambi first hit theaters.
Wow, man. So that's cool too, that it was in the way of selling books back then, of like serializing first and then collecting it. Like, that's how, as the printed word dies in this current time, it's interesting to remember when, wow, a story could be so popular in a magazine, it then gets collected as a book.
You know, Bambi serialized in a magazine, then collected, just like One Piece.
There's so many similarities.
We're finding connections. Oh, yeah, I felt like apparently the original localization was by a guy named Whitaker Chambers. Apparently it's very bad. And then Whitaker Chambers was revealed to be a Soviet spy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Huh. That's very interesting. But hey, but they were our friends in the 30s.
But it was more like he fell too in love with communism. I think it was what it was. And that's when it was fashionable in America.
That's interesting. Well, actually, now I say, no, they were our friends in the 40s. They weren't our friends in the 30s. They were Hitler's friends then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
History is complex. So, yes, Sultan is a Jewish man living in Austria in the 1930s, and that's not good. So the Nazi party banned sales of his book because he's Jewish.
Fuck.
That happens in 1935. And in 1939, thanks to his connections in high society in Austria, he was able to obtain a special permit that would allow him to live in Switzerland. But there was a catch. He couldn't be a journalist or be active in politics. And I couldn't go over all of his bio stuff here, but on top of being an author, he was a big-time journalist. I believe he started a newspaper, and he was way into that kind of thing. But they said, you're living in Switzerland, we're neutral, no journalism for you, young man.
Wow, man. Like, they want to cut out his tongue if they're going to let him go there. Wow, that's, oh, man. That's great. Well, I'm glad he got out. Jeez.
Yes. He didn't live very much longer, though, so... Oh. Unfortunately, Sultan sold the movie rights to Bambi for a mere $1,000. More on that later. Ooh. He was not able to reap the rewards of the Disney film. Apparently, he was able to live comfortably for the final 6 years of his life, but he passed away in October 1945 at age 76. So just as the war is coming to an end, he passes away, you know, at the ripe old age of 76. And it goes without saying that while I like the Disney movie, it misses the point of the book completely. Sultan's original work is very autobiographical, also an allegory for events happening in the world at the time. The Disney tale ignores Sultan's grim story of persecuted groups living on the fringes of society, and it tells a much more sentimental, the Disney version tells a much more sentimental version with a happy ending.
No, I mean, well, boy, I wonder what the other ending was, but I mean, it's the typical thing. I mean, they made an entire movie about it called Saving Mr. Banks, but the story usually was that when Walt adapts something, it's Walt's story. It's very much like Hayao Miyazaki in that way, too.
And I will say, I'll talk about the book soon, but a fun fact about Salton is that two of his other books became Disney movies, both live action. One was called Perry, The Youth of a Squirrel, and that became the 1957 animal documentary Perry. And Salton's story, The Hound of Florence, became 1959's The Shaggy Dog.
What?
Yes. What? If you watch the Shaggy Dog movie with Tim Allen, you're watching a story from the same guy who wrote Bambi.
That's incredible. Wow. The Shaggy. Now, I figured they were both going to just be an obscure, like, thing that has no, you know, one of the 8 million forgotten Disney movies that, you know, when Disney Plus launched and everybody's like, oh yeah, Disney made a whole bunch of shit nobody remembers. But no, Shaggy Dog is slightly more memorable than most of those movies.
Yeah, and Disney for a very long time made all of these documentaries that are completely forgotten about, and they won like tons of Oscars for them. They were very, very popular, but no longer doing that for like decades.
Yeah, and then on that previously mentioned Burbank trip I went on, one of the fun pictures you got to take, you got to actually hold an Oscar from their vaults, and it was a random documentary Oscar as well. They're like, yeah, we got a million of these things.
Take one home. Who cares? Yeah, I to talk about the book, I don't want to spoil too much. I will say the Bambi the movie gets most of the beats of the book, the important beats of the book. But it doesn't provide the context in which those beats exist in the book, which I find troublesome. I do enjoy both of them on their own terms. I know what to expect of a Disney movie from 1942, but the book surprised me with how gripping and dark it could be, and how like realistically observed Bambi's alienation was, because a big part of the story is, you know, humans are bad. A lot of the book is the animals talking like, what are humans? What do they want from us? Why do they do this to us? And the scene in which Bambi's mother dies in the movie, that happens in the book. But in the book, like, everything dies in that scene. It's a complete horrible bloodbath. Animals just dying tragically, bleeding out while talking to Bambi. Bambi has no idea what's going on. It's a much longer, much darker scene. It's not even shown to you in the book that the mother dies. Like, there's chaos, and the mother just disappears, and Bambi never knew what even happened to her. And in a big part of the book is Bambi, like, coming to terms with, like, there is this threat that could easily kill us all. What do we do? And the lesson Bambi learns that the patriarchs of the forest teach him is you have to learn to be alone. This is the only way to survive in a world of chaos where everything you love can be ripped apart, ripped from you at any point. You have to learn to be alone. Make no connections. Be happy alone. And that's why in the movie, we see these you know, adult male deers who are just these distant figures. That's what Bambi eventually becomes at the end of the movie. And you're like, well, Bambi loved all these guys. Why is he hanging out on the cliff alone? The book explains Bambi is so traumatized from just seeing this wanton murder of all of his friends, he just retreats from society, and that's the end of the book. And I think Salton is not saying that's what you should do. I think he's being critical of that kind of response, where he's saying that's a natural response in a world in which world wars are happening, but we cannot let this happen to ourselves.
Wow, man. So instead of at the end of the movie, it's his almost like, you know, it's more about the circle of life and how he's like, well, now he's the Prince of Forest. Now he's the guy in charge. He replaces his father. It's more of just like, oh, he turned into an isolated man just like the other patriarchs did. Like,
man. Yeah. And all the male deer do is just like hide all day.
Wow.
And they don't hang out with the other animals. They occasionally show up to be like, you're too soft. You need to get a lot harder, boy. And then they eventually just go and retreat. Bambi's mother dying, of course, it's you know, ages-old tragedy that has made every child cry for like 80 years. There is a character named Gobo in the book Bambi that I thought had a much more tragic story, where Gobo is one of Bambi's cousins. And by the way, Feline is Bambi's attractive cousin in the book.
You know, it's the animal kingdom, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and the animals will do that, but they don't have children together in the book. So Gobo, This cute little deer, he's frail, he's afraid of everything, Bambi's friends with him. When that hunting scene happens, Gobo just lays down and says, I can't run anymore. I'm just going to let them kill me. And Bambi has to leave him behind. And it's you assume that Gobo is dead. And these are book spoilers, but I don't think most people are going to read the book. So I'm just going to continue. You think Gobo is dead. Gobo appears much later in the book. And you're like, Gobo's back. Whoa, what happened to Gobo? And Gobo's like, oh, actually, the humans are nice. And they put this nice collar around me and they fed me and they kept me warm. And humans, you guys are going to love them. They're actually pretty good. And, you know, the next time humans come around, I'm going to go out and say hi to them and I'll show you. We can make a connection. Humans come back. Gobo goes out to see them. You'll never guess what happens to little Gobo.
Oh, no, not Gobo.
Yes. Gobo just murdered mercilessly by humans. So
they're like
the animals in the book, there's this like little promise dangled in front of them. Like, maybe we can figure something out with the humans. Gobo is proof that there will never be peace.
Because if he found the one, like he got lucky and found some nice humans, and then that just dooms him for the next time he meets a regular human who just kills him?
Yeah, it's very dark. Yeah. And this is what like just shatters Bambi, and he can't like just make connections with anyone anymore. He's like, there's just no hope. So I'll read this excerpt that just shows you how much different in tone the book is. And I did tweet about this. By the time you hear this podcast, it'll be weeks old. So here's an excerpt from Bambi. So Bambi had met Feline that night. She looked sadly at him and was very shy. I'm alone so much, she said softly. I'm also alone, Bambi replied hesitantly. Why don't you stay with me anymore, Feline asked humbly. And it hurt Bambi to see the cheerful and lively Feline so serious and submissive. I must be alone, he replied. Even though he wanted to say this in a mild tone, it sounded hard. He felt it himself. Feline looked at him and asked softly, do you still love me? I don't know, Bambi answered in the same tone. She walked silently away from him and left him alone. And this is kind of the last time Bambi sees Feline.
That is heavy. Wow.
Yeah. It is so heavy, Doc. And this novel is not designed to bring you down. There are all these moments of beauty. It is just the joy of a creature experiencing the wonders of nature for the first time. So along with all the ugliness, there is a lot of beauty. But I think the Disney movie doesn't really care about these kind of story ideas or lessons or context. They're really about like, oh, a deer has fun. And then the mom dies. But then immediately he's horny. And then the adventure is more fun. And then, you know, the movie ends. And again, the book provides context for things that are not provided in the movie, where a certain scene in the movie, there are rivals for Feline that Bambi fights off. In the book, that scene happens as well, but Bambi is thinking, why do I want to fight these other deer? I used to like them, but this instinct in me tells me I must hurt them. So it's just showing like it's an animal thinking consciously about these instincts it doesn't understand. And there are things like that that are harder to convey in a movie, but I feel like they make the Disney version a lot more simplistic.
Well, you know, if they put in all that, if they took all that time to ruminate on Bambi's alienation and growing distant from people he used to love, there'd be less time for Thumper's many funny jokes and pratfalls.
That's true. I do love Thumper, but I did spoil stuff in the book, but I do recommend the book. I you know, I was reading it for my work and I was like, well, I guess I got to read Bambi. Here it goes. But I really, really like the book. And even though I told you some of the plot details, I encourage you to read it because it's not what you're expecting, and it is very, very gripping.
I'm going to get that on Kindle right now. You know what? I'm going to do that. But the new one, not the public domain one.
Yes, the Princeton Press by, what's his name? I'm looking at my notes. It is Jack Zipes.
Jack Zipes, okay.
Live action purchasing is happening right now on the podcast.
Boom, there it is.
Let's check back in with Henry next month.
All right, bought it. There we go.
I want to see you in tears, my friend.
Well, it's attractive how short you said it was, too. So I was like, oh, okay.
It is like 170 pages or something like that. It's like reading a Kurt Vonnegut book. But yeah, that is the history of the book, which, yes, very much forgotten about. It's kind of like trivia, like, oh, did you know Bambi's written based on a book? And I think most people maybe might know that, but not what the book entails and the context in which it was written and all that stuff. But again, great edition that I just read. And the people behind that book don't like the movie. Are you surprised?
No, I guess not.
Yeah, it's just like, well, everyone knows the Disney movie. Nobody cares about this great work by this author that's forgotten. So we're republishing this so you can get your eyes on why they made this movie and why this book was popular at the time.
And not to judge a book by its cover, but it is a great choice that on the cover of this edition, it's just like a photograph of a deer. Like it is, you know, they're not even trying to be cartoony or evoke the Disney approach.
Yeah, they're getting very far away from the Disney designs and the kind of Disney qualities of the movie. I want to talk about the history of the movie Bambi, too, by the way. This is not a book podcast. So we're trying to cite our sources a little more often here. I think after the H-Bomber Guy video, I was like, I want people to know I'm not just ripping things off and quoting them willy-nilly without giving them credit. So I want to note up front that I relied on Michael Barrier's very good, extremely thick book, Hollywood Cartoons, American Animation in Its Golden Age, and also all of the extras on the 2005 Platinum Edition Disney DVD. The documentary made for this DVD, The Making of Bambi, A Princess Born, is available in full on YouTube, and I believe the Disney Plus version retains a lot of the DVD extras in the extra section on that menu.
Yeah, on Disney Plus, you get a lot of the deleted scenes and also this interesting thing of like the recreation of the story meeting notes with a guy. They found somebody who really sounds like Walt Disney, and this is before AI bullshit. You could maybe think, oh, did they get like AI help? Like, so they just found a guy who really sounds like Walt.
Yeah. They found a great Disney-like actor to do the voice. Admittedly, I did not watch that extra. It was an hour and 40 minutes long. But maybe I'll give it a watch before we do the movie section. Spoilers, we're recording that a few days after we record this. So I want to start by providing context as to where Disney was by the time Bambi released in 1942. So we covered this stuff before, but here are some reminders. 1940s Pinocchio was a huge flop because it was very expensive and also because the spread of war in Europe screwed Disney out of an international release. 1941's Dumbo, we covered that last year, was made for about one-third of the budget of Pinocchio and was apparently the most financially successful Disney film of the 1940s in terms of box office profit alone, just because it was made for cheap and enough people saw it and it didn't lose money like Pinocchio did. But 1941 also brought the animator strike, which we covered in detail on the Dumbo podcast. We talked about that for about 20 minutes, so please check that out. You have access to that if you're listening to this, and if not, pay us $10 and you'll get to hear it.
It's worth it.
Yes. So, we just talked about the book for about 20 minutes. So even though it's barely read today, Bambi, A Life in the Woods was a pretty big success. The original poster for Bambi literally has an illustration of the actual book with the text, "The famous book of the month becomes the picture of the year." So they're referencing, you've all read the book, now it's time to watch the movie. By book of the month, they were referring to the actual subscription service, which has existed since 1926. You can still do this today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's why in the old Looney Tunes, they'd have a blank of the month joke and all that. But it was all just playing off of the book of the month subscription service.
Yeah, it's been going strong for almost 100 years. Now it's all digital, of course. So, and yes, the book, I want to stress, the book is very, very popular. People have read this. Like, Book of the Month was kind of like Oprah's book club of its day. So if you watch the original trailer for Bambi, you see the then 13-year-old book literally sliding out of a bookcase and opening up saying, yes, the book you all love, we've made it into a movie. So this thing being based on the book was a very important part of the marketing. Which is funny now because nobody really understands this was ever an original work.
Wow, that's so great. The first release, they're all about selling you the thing that's a book. And now, again, when Disney tries to get so far away from adapting anything or like giving credit to anything, to learn how much they were advertising it based on the book is that's quite different.
It was a different time. They had a lot less power back then. So naturally, Bambi, A Life in the Woods attracts attention from a different kind of woods, Hollywoods. I apologize for that. But so MGM producer Sidney Franklin buys the rights to the novel in 1933. He wants to make it into a live action film, but he realizes like, oh, God, this is going to be impossible. How can I convey this material with live action, with real animals? So in 1937, he sells the rights to Walt Disney, and he's credited as a creative consultant, although I wonder if that just means part of him selling the rights was getting a credit on the film.
I mean, that's why it's, I'm glad you mentioned his name, because it's a very distracting thing at the very start of the movie that he is just like thanked on screen.
Thank you for selling us this. It's like idea seller, Sidney Franklin. So Franklin sells the rights to Bambi just a few weeks after the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And yes, we're going to cover that at some point. It's a very, very big project. So I'm a little like shy about it. Sort of like Roger Rabbit, you know, it's so important that we're shying away. But I think give us a year or two and we'll cover that. So yeah, Bambi is sold to Disney a few weeks after that movie comes out. Bambi is going to be the studio's second full-length feature film, but the team encounters big difficulties adapting this dark adult novel into something more appropriate for a family audience. So they shift gears and start working on other projects. So production wouldn't begin on Bambi until August of 1939, and Pinocchio, Fantasia, and Dumbo would all arrive in theaters right before it.
Well, that's interesting, the move away, but like the Bambi could have been the next one. It makes, you know, because Snow White does have so much like naturalism and the forest and the animals and all that stuff. It makes sense that Bambi would, you know, be the natural follow to it instead of the instead of something as experimental as Fantasia or as silly as Dumbo. Also, it's funny that it comes right after Dumbo because Dumbo, Bambi, similar naming conventions, and also Sad Little Orphan Boys.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, a story of an animal and his mother,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a big part of why they wanted to do Bambi is the Snow White was very hard to do because, you know, it was them doing this for the first time, Disney doing it for the first time. Other people had made animated features, but they realized, you know, with Snow White, we had to draw like 7 humans at once. What if we did more with animals? They seem easier to draw. That was a big appeal of Bambi. And then the backgrounds are going to be a little easier because we're not, you know, making buildings or realistic settings. It's all going to be outside, seemingly easier to convey than locations humans would normally be in.
Mm-hmm. Seemingly. I have a feeling It didn't end up being that way.
They had a lot to figure out. So let's talk about the production of Bambi. Though it should be noted, after Snow White, Disney wanted to be revolutionary by saying, you know, we spent so much time on Snow White. Let's have our studio operate with 2 different pictures in production at once. We talked about this on Dumbo because he filed things into 2 categories, which were the terms straight drawing and caricature. And he wanted in production at once a straight drawing movie and a caricature movie. In terms of straight drawing, he meant basically a more expensive movie that didn't rely on cartooniness as much. So Snow White and Pinocchio and Bambi are all straight movies. Dumbo was their caricature movie. So that's the meaning of those terms, which are like exclusive to Disney at that time. No one else really used them.
Yeah, as you characterized the production of Dumbo a year ago, it was like the shorts team getting to make a full movie, but not, and like the older than the old men guys, like the old guys who taught the 9 old men.
Yeah, the director of this movie, we'll talk about him soon, he was slightly too old to be one of the 9 old men. But let's talk about the Bambi production history. So with Bambi, instead of animating specific characters when they appear in a scene, like, okay, I am Pinocchio's lead animator. If there's a scene with Pinocchio, I'm in charge of all the Pinocchio animation in this scene. Of course, people are helping me, but I'm the lead on this. Instead of doing things like that, scenes were given to animators where I'm the animator. I have every character in this scene. I'm just doing an entire scene myself. Basically, this led to a bunch of mini directors underneath the supervising director of the film. So they're doing things a bit differently this way. And this was pitched by Milt Kahl because he was honestly very tired of drawing the same character over and over again during these feature productions. In this case, Pinocchio was sick of drawing Pinocchio over and over. And the thought of having to do that again for another film made him think there's got to be a better way to do this. There was that, but there was also the challenge of having to sync your own animation up with somebody else's animation. So if you are the second person on a scene, you are syncing your animation up to already created animation, which is a very unique challenge that they thought, like, we have to work around this in some way. There's got to be a different way to do this. So this is what was pitched to Disney in a way he could understand, that it would save him money. Because a scene would not be held up because an animator was working on their character on another scene. This would be more cost effective. Walt Disney was worried at first that, like, oh, if more than one animator handles a character, it could be inconsistent. But Kahl had proof that it could work because he and Frank Thomas had split duties on the character of Pinocchio in Pinocchio, and there were no inconsistencies between their scenes. And also, by using live action reference, animators' work could be more consistent between their own takes. So This is how they won over Disney, and this is how there are sequence directors on Dumbo instead of, like, Bambi is this guy and Thumper is that guy.
Well, it's man, that because that's still not how, like when we just did Emperor's New Groove, it was very strictly in the character animation thing and the assigned character animator. They even go over how, you know, for one scene they did it a little differently where like they actually kind of traded instead of just as in one guy drew Pacha and then for the reply he then passed it back over for Kuzco's reply instead of fully doing Pacha for the whole scene and then Kuzco. But you know, when the only other time I've heard about on one of the movies we've talked about of having just full scene animator instead of character ones was actually Shrek. That they said that was a mistake on Shrek.
Yeah, I don't know if this was a good idea or a bad idea. Maybe improve morale for the animators. I don't know when they went back to casting animators for characters, but with Bambi, at least, this was a new thing for Disney. And based on the quality of Bambi, I'm not thinking, oh, Bambi looks bad in this scene or Thumper looks weird. I feel like it is consistent, and maybe it's because the designs are simpler for then, you know, a human wearing, you know, clothing, having a distinct face and all the other things that go into drawing a person.
I'm not going to Tumblr to complain about off-model Bambi in the sliding sequence.
If you look close enough, you can see some off-model Bambis.
The spots are in the wrong place in this shot.
Yes, actually, the spots do jump around. But yeah, Milt Kahl and Frank Thomas are big engineers behind the production of Bambi. They're the first people assigned sequences on Bambi by the end of 1939. And by March of 1940, Walt is able to see some of their rough animation and realize, like, okay, this sequence director thing is going to work. You've convinced me. Frank Thomas is the one behind the famous ice skating scene because at the time he was learning how to ice skate. And in the scene, basically, he is Bambi. And Thumper is like the other people who are much better at it, who are around him, kind of mocking him.
I love that sequence, and it's such great physical comedy. And I remember in the Frank and Ollie doc, they were talking about that one and also how they did, how much they love this flypaper sequence with Pluto in one of the classic Pluto shorts. I'm just thinking about how well done that awkward four-legged motion was done in that one. It almost feels like practice for this scene in Bambi.
Yeah, I mean, they did animal characters before. You know, Snow White loves the animals. They're prancing around her. But this time, they wanted to level up their animal animation from what happened in Snow White. So this is when they bring in live deer to the studio to do basically life drawing of these animals. And then, like, after I sat down to watch Bambi for long enough, about 30 minutes in, I'm like, boy, deer have weird bodies. They have these weird triangular butts that stick out. They're much more complicated than you would think.
Yeah, I just looking at Bambi, I mean, that shows you just how great the job they did with interpreting the character, the movements of it. But like, yeah, I just look at the legs and I'm like, wow, the knees don't bend where you think a knee bends on a deer, or just it's like the hindquarters, the way the it kind of bunches up, and just, yeah, none of it looks right for a deer. And just to have a deer stumbling around, like, that had to be incredible to see. Like, you've never seen anything like that in animation before.
There was something on the DVD where they were talking about how in Snow White, the deer you see in that movie are an animator remembering, I know what a deer looks like. But in Bambi, it's them having experience of seeing a deer up close, sketching it, figuring out how it moves. Like, hands-on deer experience. So, yeah, they bring the deer in. And the designs of the deer are a mix of story sketch artist Bernard Garbutt's drawings. And then the facial features were designed by Mark Davis, and they were based on the expressions of human babies. So Milt Kahl is the guy who marries Bernard Garbutt's drawings and Mark Davis's facial expressions to make the iconic Bambi design.
Wow. And again, like not that it was fully taken from it, but like Tezuka, who would inspire pretty much every Japanese comic artist that followed him, like he took a lot. He was very inspired by the eye designs for Bambi and the character models.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, would we have anime eyes if not for Bambi? I know Tezuka was likely inspired by other sources, but these eyes, the anime eyes, when we see them, they're just Bambi eyes, right?
Yeah, I know. It's why they're called doe eyes. And just like Bambi has just beautiful, beautiful eyes. And also all this stuff about like the live animals. I mean, they did it for real. It wasn't a marketing gimmick, but definitely like for guys like Jeffrey Katzenberg, sorry to, I have to say him on the show, but that they saw these things about like, here's how they filmed animals to make Bambi. He definitely was thinking of that when he's like, okay, let's get in the lions and film us drawing the lions for Lion King so we can show that we're doing it the way Disney used to.
And so, yeah, they bring in the deer, and then Chinese-American artist Tyrus Wong is the guy spearheading the background art design. He was, I think he was a greeting card designer for Hallmark, but they weren't sure what to do with the backgrounds because they thought, you know, maybe being photorealistic would be very expensive. Would the designs get lost in these very detailed backgrounds? But Tyrus Wong brought the style of, like, Chinese landscape painting to Bambi. And it's very impressionistic. It gives the idea of what you should be seeing, but it's not like every tree is rendered realistically, every branch, every shadow. It's sort of what the live-action Disney remakes miss, the CGI ones, where it's like, no, it must look like a documentary, where Bambi is going for just a very impressionistic style with its backgrounds. The characters pop so much on those backgrounds, and it looks great, and it's all thanks to Tyrus Wong leading this charge here.
You're so right that it's like, no, the new stuff in the remakes are like, well, yeah, it just has to look like it's filmed in the real world, or they just film it in the real world and then like spruce it up some. But yeah, these the backgrounds in Bambi are some of the, like, the most gorgeous backgrounds you've ever seen in animation. Like, it's just so beautiful, and the way you move through them, like, it, I feel like it still in many ways is rarely matched in modern animation. Even with all the stuff that computers can do for multi-layer effects and multi-panning, they can have so many more layers than Bambi can have, but and yet still Bambi is so gorgeous.
Yeah, I think if we were to sit somebody down after watching Bambi and you would say, do you think the backgrounds are realistic? They'd be like, oh yeah, look like they're really in the woods. But then if you would go back frame by frame and show them, like, we'll see how this is impressionistic and see how this is like the suggestion of a tree, they would realize, like, oh, they work so well, I never thought these were more abstracted from the photorealistic nature photography it wants to evoke, or it wants to simplify to make the characters pop more. So yeah, it's very subtle, I think, but if you're paying close attention, you realize just like, they're just like show so many shapes indicating things, and it's not like every shadow realistically observed on the ground. It looks so great.
And because the point of the story is to go through the seasons, then it allows them to, you know, even if they're in the same area from scene to scene, it's like it still feels so different each time you revisit it as time moves forward.
And because it's the woods and you're not like, you know, having locations people need to remember to keep track of a story, it doesn't matter if, you know, oh, it's the one tree Bambi stands by. No, it doesn't matter what any tree looks like or what any blade of grass looks like. Nothing needs to be, no part of the setting needs to be recognizable for the story to make sense.
That's true, yeah.
So on our What a Cartoon Movie episode about Dumbo, we mentioned that film was nearly finished before the strike happened, but some people had to cross the picket line to finish Dumbo. So in terms of Bambi, the team made significant progress on this film by the time the strike happened in May of 1941. It ended in September, but it wasn't as complete as Dumbo, and the movie was still in the final stages of cleanups and in-betweening when the strike happened, and inking and painting would not be complete until the beginning of December of 1941. And then there were even more production problems. So a preview was planned just before Christmas of 1941. Before that could happen, Walt Disney decided an instrumental part of the score needed some lyrics, so that added another month to the schedule, and what was once an Easter release soon slipped 4 months into being an August release. And I will say, the songs in Bambi are so, they're barely there, and I'm wondering, like, which of the songs was added after, like, later by Disney. Maybe the raindrop song? I don't know. He insisted that, like, some part that was once instrumental now have lyrics, and that added a lot of time to the production.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, the only song I remember the words to is the April Shower song. And honestly, it's because my mom used to sing it to me when it rained. So it's it has a cheat code for being memorable to me.
Maybe it is that Let's Sing a Gay Little song. Is that the name of it?
I think you're right. Yes. Yeah, that's the We'll Sing a Gay.
They're like, sing a gay song.
Yeah, it's a gay ass song for such a heterosexual movie as the Twitter painted sequence.
Yes, actually, the full name of it is Let's Sing a Gay Little Spring Song. Which, now, I mean, yeah, isn't it funny how gay means something different now? Ha ha. But it is for like this gay little spring song. I guess we should sing it. It does sound like an insult to me.
It made me chuckle. It made me chuckle.
Yeah, you know, in so many ways, I am a lowbrow human being. And when I see the word gay used sincerely by people in the 40s, I'm like, that is pretty funny.